Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
Happy Monday, DJ. Before I forget to say anything, it's almost your birthday. Don't worry, I won't put you on blast today. Are you excited to be 21 tomorrow?
I am very excited
Big
to be 26 tomorrow.
You.
I am
Big
so
day.
Excited.
Before I get to any of that, now we are going to have Mike Salk finally makes a return with us. We loved having 2 days with Groz, though. Especially good to talk to him about what he was seeing from Jared Kelnick and Logan Gilbert, two names that we are all watching when it comes to the Seattle Mariners. And Jake, you said something, and you are not worried about Jared Kelnick. Not only are you not worried, it's kind of starting to annoy you that people are getting worried.
Well, I think that there's a lot of conversation that's obviously going on with him, and everybody's focused on the lack of hitting, and rightfully so. That's something that you don't want to see. I mean, we were talking about potentially creeping up on a record of however many hits that you can go and go hitless. I mean, what's the record, DJ? Where are we looking at? 0-50?
Pretty sure it's 0-53, okay. But I'll double check that. It's bad.
So 0-53, we're around 0-39 is where we're at. So not necessarily the record that you want to be approaching, but I also think that when you talk about these prospects, there's two prospects that they called up here. We have two of them, and there's two heading in different directions, opposite directions that we wouldn't necessarily want to see. But I think that there is positive to go along with the negative. And just very shortly before we really dive into it, with Jared Kelnick, it's something that has become tiresome to me because it seems like panic that's happening too soon. It's not something you want to see. I'm not saying that it's great. Jared Kelnick going 0-39, not great. But guess what? I'm not worried about it because there's been so many people along the way that as we talked about Jared Kelnick and his development and his process, I think there's a lot that you have to remind yourself along the way. And we've asked, you know, Jonathan Mayo about this situation with Jared Kelnick, and go to cut number one. Here's what his response was.
Baseball's hard. So I'm not reading too much into it. It is what he's got 70 some at bats. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's struggled. He's also shown glimpses of what he can do. You know, the power has shown up a little bit. He can run, he can do things in the outfield. I'm not too concerned. You know, it's one of those things. It really jumps off the page because that's how he started out. But if he were an established veteran and went through a 19 game stretch where, you know, he didn't hit, no one would notice.
So also going on top of that, I asked Jonathan Mayo in cut number two, when would be the time that you would start to worry? When would you begin to start hitting that panic button? Here's what he said.
I mean, for me, like 2023. Like, you know, unless you really feel certain that the Mariners are definitely going to compete, first of all, I think they're better with him in the lineup. Mm. You know, so I think that they should ride it out. Now, if he's still hitting, you know, .120 and it's July, then maybe you think, you know what, go back down, catch your breath, and then come back, you know, sort of the Taylor Trammell route. You know, but I'm really not too worried about it. I think he's going to figure it out.
So he said 2023. He said in July about putting him down. Now, I wouldn't go on those same lines. I think that putting him down a little bit sooner would probably be better for him ultimately. But again, I'm not worried about it. Why? Because this is part of the developmental process. Would I have loved to have seen him come up and rake and be successful right from the get-go? Absolutely. But I know that he has not failed at any point in his career. Stacey, he's never failed. He's been a prodigy, a baseball prodigy, since he was a young kid. And this organization deemed that in his developmental process, and I'm going to continue to believe that because the alternative would just have me really, really upset. And that alternative that Danny O'Neill was pointing to earlier this morning was that, look, the Mariners panicked because everybody else was pressuring them. Everybody else was asking about Jared Kelnick. When is he going to be up? When is he going to be up? And eventually they caved in and brought him up before he was ready. I would like to think that that isn't the case. I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt in that and go to the facts. Go to the point of where they felt like, in their own words, they felt like he was ready to come up. and also something that we had Jason Churchill on a couple weeks ago talking about this very same thing, is that the AAA level might not have been the place where he needed to fail. He might have needed to come up to the big league level to experience failure, to go through that maturation process, and then have to go from there in terms of adjustments, maybe coming back down to the AAA level, but that's not unheard of.
Yeah, I think that what a lot of people are getting upset about, and I'm looking at the stats right now for Kelnick just over the season. I mean, 8-for-83 in 2021 is not great. I know that he's on pace to break an MLB record, which also isn't great. I still find myself kind of in the same boat as you are, where I'm not worried about it. And I think it's because I expected just a lot of struggles this year for the Mariners, especially for their young guys. Also because this offense as a whole is struggling. And so it's hard to just pinpoint, you know, one person. Kelnick is not contributing to their success right now. He is not being a boost. But maybe that was the fault in all of this all along, I think. And I'll totally put myself in that group too. Now, I didn't expect Kelnick to be called up as soon as he was. I also think that I expected him to come into the lineup and be one of their better players right away, which was, I think, foolish in hindsight, but hindsight's 20/20. And I think that the hopes that people are pinning on Gilbert, who we'll talk about in a second, who had a great day, and Kelnick, are in part because of the long-lasting frustration and desire to get back to the postseason. When you pin your hopes on someone, you do live day-to-day in their success. It is hard to think Kelnick can be part of our path forward, and let's hope in 2023 we get this figured out. If you're a Mariners fan, you've been like, hang on a minute, it's been since 2001.
Right.
I don't want to look at 2023 as let's hope this is when it happens. I don't think it is weird that people were seeing Kelnick as kind of like a savior that could come in and help. I also think that that has contributed to a lot of the negative conversation around him right now.
I fully agree with that, but I think that's also us as fans not actually thinking this one through in terms of thinking that he's going to be the savior of the team and where they were at the time. It would be great to be able to have that story written down, that he's called up and he takes off and he is this He again, we have two AL rookies of the year right back to back, that everything goes smoothly. But I also think that we maybe have set ourselves up to look past some of the fact that he hasn't had that many at bats over single A, that he didn't get a ton of at bats at the double A level, that he's moved up really, really fast. Why? Because he's extremely talented. The other fact that he didn't get a full minor league season under his belt the way that the Mariners had designed because of COVID last year. That was a big wrench thrown into their developmental plans. And so I believe that you're getting twofold. You're getting Kelnick the opportunity to come up to the big league level, see the show, get the experience. You're hoping that eventually he finds that success, no question. But it's not the end of the world if he doesn't, because he needs that experience. He needs that failure. As we can clearly see, there is such a huge divide between what you see in the minors at the AAA level and below versus what you see at the bigs. And the only way to experience that is to go experience it. There's no replacement. And so what I would love to have Jared Kelnick packaged up perfectly and ready to go and it take off, yes, absolutely. But that's not realistic to baseball. That's not realistic to the process. And so am I excited? Am I thrilled to see 0-for-39? No, I'm not excited to see that at all, but I'm not hitting the panic button saying, uh-oh, this isn't going to work out. Uh-oh, this is going to be another failed prospect. Uh-oh, the Mariners screwed this one up again. I'm just not there. I'm not there with that. This is a year for Jared Kelnick where he's got to learn, grow, and develop. And if he has to come up, if he has to be sent down, someone on the text line said, I think sending him down would be better phrase than putting him down. That concerns me a little
Jake,
bit. Very fair.
Come on.
Very fair. We are not putting him down. We are sending him down. I think that,
I tell
that would
you,
be
every
okay.
Every time Jake switches one word, it's hilarious.
Because it means something drastically different. But sending him down would not be the end of the world. And it might be something that's good that he needs along the process. I will not panic this entire year when it comes to Jared Kelnick. This is a developmental year that he's got to learn and see what it's like at the big league level. Hopefully we see those adjustments made in the second half of the season. But, Stacey, can we talk about the guy who's heading in the other direction? The guy that should have all positive talk about him right now, another Mariner prospect in Logan Gilbert that was brought up.
That's exactly right. So Logan Gilbert gets his first win of the season. The Mariners topped the Angels 9-5 last night. Gilbert fans 7. Five innings pitch allows just 2 hits and 1 earned run. That run, by the way, was a home run. It came early, so at first it looked like it was going to be bad news bears against an Angels lineup that's even fairly decent still without Trout, right? Like, I think they're middle of the road, OPS-ish. I mean, their pitching is really the big problem for that team. So it was going to be a test. It was going to be a test against Upton, against Ohtani, and he ends up pitching a great game. Certainly his best outing so far. DJ, you were noticing his slider especially was just deadly.
Yeah, and you read...
And Jake has also...
Yeah. You read everything that Jonathan Mayo said. Like Joe Doyle, who's a great Twitter follower as well, is that he needs to start using his off-speed more, his slider. When his slider is on, hitters are lost. They are completely lost. Like Ohtani, he struck him out on a backdoor slider. I mean, Ohtani looked foolish. Ohtani's been one of the best hitters in baseball. So his off-speed stuff, when he starts getting that on, mm-hmm. it's... This is the next step for Logan Gilbert. This is when he's going to take that leap.
It is, and I think when you anytime you said one of your favorite things in all of sports, favorite moments is when a player gets their first home run, mm-hmm. right? First ever home run, that's one of your favorites.
Yep.
So Logan Gilbert got his first win last night. That is something to be excited about. That is a special moment that deserves acknowledgement. And what also deserves acknowledgement is his improvement, his progression over the last 2 starts. You talk about implementing more of the off-speed stuff, DJ, how great that's been for him. And he came in being mostly a fastball pitcher, and he's really trying to overuse that the first couple starts, and he got hit for it. He got punished for it. He made adjustments along the way. That, to me, is an exciting thing, and you're right. His off-speed stuff is special. When he has command of his slider and his changeup, his curveball a couple times got way out there, especially at the beginning of the game. Was wondering where he was going with some of those pitches. Tom Murphy had to come out to the mound. And as Logan Gilbert said before, he's scared of Tom Murphy, so I wonder how that conversation went. I couldn't help think that. It was just like Logan Gilbert was like, yeah, anything you say. Yes, sir. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
But whatever that conversation was with Murphy, it worked because he really started to turn it around. Yesterday in his start, he used around 60% of his fastball. I think as he gets that closer to 50%, I really believe that's when he's going to start to take off, when he really truly feels in command of his off-speed stuff, because it's really good. And guys have a really hard time, hitters have a really hard time tracking it, and so I'm really excited to see that. But what's really stood out to me, guys, in the last couple starts where Gilbert's been able to get deeper into innings, it hasn't been clean. It has not been clean starts for him. Mm-hmm. He has not had a clean start from the beginning of the game all the way through the end. But what we have seen the last 2 starts in particular is him have a rough go of it at the beginning, and then him show some mental toughness, him really display that he isn't going to get rattled in those moments, and he's been able to get out of a jam. He's been able to, after rough starts, finish relatively clean towards the end of his outings, and that to me is really impressive. I mean, put this in perspective. We were talking about Yusei Kikuchi, him taking the next step this year. Why? It wasn't because of his stuff. His stuff's always been incredible, but he has struggled mightily when he finally gets guys on base, when hitters are able to hit him for the first time and guys are running in scoring position. He's really struggled in those situations over the last couple years. Logan Gilbert shown himself the ability and the confidence to get himself out of jams.
Yeah, a lot of pitching is a mental game too. And I mean, speaking of Kikuchi, I think a lot of the struggle has been getting him, and we've heard Service talk about this before in years past, like getting him to not overthink pitches, not tinker too much. And I'm sure he's not alone in doing that, that so much of what you have to do is just have confidence in your stuff, in addition to executing it perfectly, right? Like, that's not easy, but it was good to see on display early. I mean, that home run was first pitch to Upton. First pitch to Upton right out of the park.
Right.
Fly ball to center or left center field. Seeing that bounce back quickly, walks Ohtani not great. Then you start getting out. I mean, it's a rough first. And after that, you see it smooth out a bit and you start seeing him take a bit more control back. I mean, it wasn't perfect. I still think it was one of his best yet. And if you can say anything, it's that his last, I think two, is it the last one that was maybe his solid since then, that you have at least seen improvement, which is one of the best things you can see as a Mariners fan.
It was absolutely great. And also, how about when you get Gilbert, a couple times he battled with Ohtani, and second time around in the fourth, he gets Ohtani to strike out on a nasty slider right here.
Gilbert looks in, has the sign. Runners get their leads. They go 3-2 pitch slider. Swing and a miss for strike three. A slider down and in. Logan Gilbert striking out Shohei Ohtani. Strikeout number five for Gilbert, and he strikes out the side here in the bottom of the fourth inning. Holy smokes. What a performance by Logan Gilbert.
Oh, yeah. That's what I'm talking about. Okay. I want to hear a lot more of that in the future, Stacey.
All right. It is time for headlines.
Extra, extra, read all about it.
Headlines.
Presented by Tila Mortgage.
The real story behind the headlines in today's news with Jake and Stacey.
All right, some news coming across my table here as we talked about. Logan Gilbert silences Shohei Ohtani and the Angels lineup with another good start, going five innings, only giving up two hits, one earned run, and striking out seven.
This is what it should have said. Good news. The Mariners bullpen didn't completely blow Logan Gilbert's start, but it wasn't for lack of trying. Now, I say that kind of tongue-in-cheek because I actually think the worst performance you saw instead was Kikuchi's start gets injured in, what was it, the fifth. You had the grand slam the inning prior, and then it just completely falls off, not just for the Mariners' offense, but for the bullpen. So that certainly influenced a bit of this headline. I don't think you saw as poor a showing from the bullpen this time around. And you know what I'll say, Jake? I do think you're going to see improvement there. That bullpen has mostly been solid earlier this season. They're going to get Graveman back. I am starting
about
to feel
time
that.
I've missed you, Graveman.
I'm starting to feel the familiar feeling of nerves with one run allowed for the Mariners pitching from Gilbert in the first, and then no run, and then the eighth and ninth, you have four to make what felt like just a blowout, a 9-5 game.
You know what, Stacey? You know who this is really directed at? This is really directed at one pitcher. We all know who it is, Rafael Montero. Rafael Montero is a roller coaster of an experience. Every time he is pitching, as he's getting warmed up and loose in the pen, you're thinking to yourself, oh, man, not again. And I think with Montero, sometimes it feels like it's a Fernando Rodney experience a little bit, where he pushes the envelope and ultimately gets it done. But he's really cost you a couple games. And so I think for the remainder of the season, you are always going to be worried about when Rafael Montero hits the mound.
And I completely understand. I see this, see Seattle's initial intrigue for him, though. After he had Tommy John, correct? I mean, the velocity on his fastball went up year over year. I understand why they felt like he could potentially be one of the better arms in that bullpen. It's just, it's starting to be a little bit of like an exercise in nerves management as a Mariners fan.
Oh, yeah, it's like a Seattle Seahawks football game experience when Montero's on the mound.
Next story.
Headlines.
All right, this coming across my timeline here. Russell Wilson posted to his Instagram of him landing in Seattle, signaling he'll be attending OTAs this week.
New headline. Everyone's stepdad storming around the house looking for something else to be mad about. This is inspired by my own stepdad, who I love dearly, but who does storm around the house looking for things. Did someone leave a light on? I feel like that's how people angry about Russell Wilson not being at OTAs. They're just looking for something else to be mad at him about. I clicked on the story. I think it was your initial tweet, Jake, and someone just comments like, oh, a private jet? Like, it's just people just want to be mad.
Or mad that I was tweeting out that he was heading to OTAs. Like, what's the problem? He posted it on Instagram. I'm putting it out there on Twitter for everybody else to see. I didn't think that would be unwelcome news. Now, it wasn't. For the most part, everybody's excited that Russell Wilson's back in town. Bobby Wagner is reported to be at OTAs as well. And Pete Carroll hinted at this, that the week before mandatory minicamp, you were going to see a lot of the veterans start to trickle in, be a part of OTAs the week prior, and you're going to get two solid weeks of practice. You're going to get two solid weeks of everybody being at the building together outside of what they've done virtually, and I think that's really a positive thing. Also, what is exciting, that we here, we will be able to watch them practice over the next couple weeks. We'll get a chance to see him and the rest of the team for two practices this week. And I'm not sure what the Seahawks have planned for media availability during mandatory minicamp,
which starts June 15th.
Yes, starts next week, which is very exciting. But we will have our chance to see eyes on these guys here over the next 2 weeks, and we'll have plenty to report on that.
All right, let's see what's hot off the presses, DJ.
Headlines.
Yes, hot off the presses indeed, and I just don't even want to read this headline.
Just get this
out of my face, please.
The Mariners
used their 48th player in 2021 over the weekend with relief pitcher Yaxel Rios. Congratulations to you, sir. Nobody else in MLB has used as many players this season so far.
This is what this headline should have said. It's 2017 again for the Seattle Mariners, but instead of an out-of-gas Felix Hernandez, they've got one of Jim Bob Duggar's 32 children. That's the only one I felt mean about. I didn't like writing that one. You know, look, I will say there was a fascinating article in The Athletic. I know Corey Brock had this in his separate article about Yusei Kikuchi's injury, but there is another kind of recap of the week's events. As of May 31st, there were 244 players around Major League Baseball on the IL. At no point last year, again, this is from The Athletic, were there anywhere close to that number of players on the IL at the same time. That's an average of 8 players per team. Mariners certainly surpassing that. And then this one was from Corey Brock, and it blew my mind. 8 players have been on the Mariners roster through the course of the season without an IL stint from the original opening day roster.
Wow.
8.
That
single digit 8.
That's incredible. And not in a good way. I am blown away by that stat. And what's also very peculiar about this is, remember the 6-man rotation. Some of it's been due to relievers, but a lot of this domino effect is because of what's happened with the starting pitching. They went with a 6-man rotation. Why? To try and keep everybody healthy. Hasn't necessarily panned out for them. Some of it's been bad luck. Some of it's just stuff that they can't control. But I just find it really ironic that the 6-man rotation was part of that development process, some of that workload management after guys coming off of a COVID year where they didn't get the same amount of reps, the same amount of innings that they normally do. And so Jerry DePoto and the rest of the staff thought it would be a great idea for them to go through with the 6-man rotation. Development-wise, it might still be the best thing. I still think it is. But in terms of the health, that hasn't necessarily panned out for them the way that they were hoping or expecting it to work out.
Well, and there's a bit of a snake bitten factor to this too. The first full season following a shortened season because of COVID, it doesn't shock me that there are more injuries potentially, even though we're hitting about the same time, right? 61 days, everyone's around game 60 or so. So it's not like you're hitting day 100, day 120, and you're starting to see injuries rack up, although I think I would expect them to continue. It doesn't shock me that in the first full season there are more injuries. I think that there's a chance teams are being just more cautious. You have a 10-day IL as opposed to a 15-day IL. But this isn't just caution for the Seattle Mariners. I mean, putting James Paxton on the 60-day IL isn't caution. He literally needed to go have surgery. You know what I mean? Like, you're having injuries that aren't just, oh, we've got some inflammation here, so we're going to be safe. I mean, there's a chance Kyle Lewis could have surgery on that torn meniscus. We're going to potentially hear about that tomorrow with Scott Servais. Certainly this week, we're going to hear an update on that.
Stacey, I've got it.
Oh, okay.
Has anybody located Kevin Mather?
No, why?
Because I'm worried that maybe he's got a bunch of voodoo dolls. What's going on? And he's coming after the team. I'm worried about that.
I don't think he would spend money on that. It seems like a waste of money for him. I think he would use one voodoo doll and just kind of like recycle different faces. He doesn't seem like someone that likes to overspend.
$5 for this voodoo doll?
What? $5? Now, is there a chance I could pay you $2 and you pay me $3 to rent the voodoo doll later? There's no other voodoo dolls around here.
$1.99.
I have the only voodoo doll
you can use. You never know. I mean, you never know. People do reckless things when they're upset. People do reckless things for vengeance.
You know what? Let's ask Mike Salk about this next. Also, he wasn't too high on Logan Gilbert's first couple starts. Let's see if last night changed his mind.
You're listening to Jake and Stacy.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
Mike Salk joining us now, brought to you by Jafco Plumbing and Sewer. Mike, I know that you had some worries about Logan Gilbert and you weren't alone, but what'd you think of his latest start, his first win?
Yeah, it was nice to see him kind of start to pitch a little bit better. I don't know if he's out of the woods yet. I mean, that fastball is still catching a lot of the plate, but it's nice to see the strikeouts go up. It's nice to see him pitching deeper into a game. And yeah, you know, wins are an unfashionable statistic in baseball for good reason, I understand, but they still mean something to players. And for him to get his first in the big leagues, hopefully the first of many, many more to come.
Salk, as you watch him play, what is it about, as you watch him pitch, what is it about him that makes you a little bit hesitant? You say, hey, it's a good performance, but he's not out of the woods yet. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's really just the fastball, Jake. It's just it doesn't seem to get by people, right? I mean, they seem to see it well. And again, that's surprising considering all of the arm action he has and the awkward angle at which you would think the ball would attack the hitter. For whatever reason, major leaguers seem to be seeing that four-seam fastball pretty darn well. It's not fooling them. And when it catches, a lot of the plate, they're taking advantage of him. So, yeah, some improvement. Once he's able to get the off-speed stuff established and once he can put some sort of a fear into a major league hitter that they have to respect something beyond that fastball, I think the fastball will start to have more effectiveness. And so the long-term is not really necessarily a concern. Just a matter of how he's able to dig himself out of this.
I feel like people are kind of two minds when it comes to Jared Kelnick. There's the first part where you just look at hits versus plate appearances, and it's not great. He's on track to potentially beat the worst hitless streak in the history of baseball. That's from Joe Doyle, MILB. Not fantastic. And then there are folks who look at the more advanced stats and say, you know what, I'm not overly concerned yet. Where do you stand?
Well, I think there's a middle ground there. Am I overly concerned about his long-term potential? No, absolutely not. He's 21 years old. I never thought he was ready necessarily for Major League Baseball. I was kind of annoyed when the Mariners brought him up when they did. Obviously, I got excited and got into the spirit of it because they're bringing up their big prospect. But, you know, this idea that they were holding him back and service time and this and that, like, hopefully that myth has now been completely debunked after this 0-for-38 or whatever it is. So I'm not worried necessarily about the long term. In the short term, yeah, I think there is some cause to worry. I don't care how many advanced metrics you see, 38 straight at bats that don't result in a hit is not a good thing at any level of baseball, including the major leagues, for one of your biggest prospects in forever. So I don't think it hurts his long term, you know, star power. But at some point, you have to do something to get this kid seeing baseballs again that he can hit. And I like that they dropped him down in the lineup. I like giving him a day or two off. If he's not able to deliver in the very near future, though, I don't see how he avoids going back to AAA just to get his confidence back.
Why didn't you think he was ready? Was it just at-bats?
It's just number of at-bats. He just hadn't seen enough pitching. And if you remember, the conversation was, how did we let Jared Kelnick fail, right? How did we get to experience him some failure without it having it happening at the major league level? And unfortunately, that's exactly where it's happening, here at the major league level. He never went through a struggle at any of the minor leagues. I'm not sure he was given enough time necessarily in AAA to go through even a slump that wasn't quite as great as this one. This is a really bad slump. As you said, one of the worst in major league history, and he's got to wear it with the eyes of baseball on him as one of the big name prospects. So we'll see how he handles it. Hopefully, you know, he's a really confident kid by all accounts. You know, he's incredibly talented. He is really young. I hope he bounces back from this, but I also wish we didn't have to find out about it at the major league level.
Yeah, I can understand that, Saul. I guess it's just where you deem that failure needed to occur, right? And you're right that they didn't let it sit long enough at the AAA level to see if it would happen there. But in their estimation, I would hope that it's not something else, but I would hope that they made this call saying that they feel like they have to bring him up to maybe experience some of that, to get that experience there at the big league level.
Yep.
But now, Salk, my question becomes, all right, is it a bad thing if they end up having to send him down? I think there's a lot of panic that that is a sign that, oh, you're signaling that he just simply wasn't ready and that now you've put yourself behind the eight ball.
Well, so what? So if he's not ready, then he's not ready. Put him back in AAA and let him get ready, right? What is the point of having him embarrassed at the big league level? And I'm not saying he needs to go down immediately. They have to make that decision, you know, as they believe it's in his best interest. But, you know, again, the whole point here was always the same thing. The idea that they needed to bring up Kelnick because they needed to add a bat to their lineup in May was always ridiculous. It was ridiculous from the very beginning. Any idea that this kid, who's one of the pillars of the future of the franchise, needs to be brought up to help them this year was just ridiculous. They need to do what's in his best interest. If they deemed that what he needed to do was experience major league pitching at that point, that he had shown all he could show at AAA, fine. Now he's experienced it. He doesn't seem to be ready to handle it at any sort of a regular or elite level. So get him back to AAA, have him work on the things he needs to work on. And I'm not going to pretend like I'm a scout or a hitting coach who can figure those things out, but they are, and that's what they do. Send him back to AAA with some very specific instructions, much like they did for Taylor Trammell, who, while certainly not, you know, an elite player, has come back significantly better than he departed. Give the kid a task, let him go master it, and then bring him back when he's ready.
Mike, switching gears here, Julio Jones ends up landing in Tennessee, not going to Seattle after all, or anywhere in the NFC West. What are your initial thoughts on that deal?
Well, I'm sure he's going to love playing with Ryan Tannehill. That sounds like a joy for
blocking
Julio.
Blocking for Derrick Henry.
Right. I mean, the whole thing just sort of seems like a mess. But, you know, look, he's an older wide receiver. Those guys have an inflated sense of their own worth because in their 20s, they're told that they're everything. They have to play at that elite kind of level. They get paid very well. The game is centered around them. They get the endorsements. They're easy to root for. And then as they get older, they still want the ball as much as they did earlier. They still believe that they're open as often as they once were. And the fact of the matter is that those things tend not to be true, even for many of the very good players. So I like Julio. He's a really, really good one. I think he'll be a bit of an awkward fit in Tennessee, and I'm curious to see how long he's happy there blocking, right? Is this going to be a Jimmy Graham issue where in a year or two we're like, why did we ever think Julio Jones blocking for Derrick Henry and catching passes from Ryan Tannehill would be a good idea? But, you know, I didn't think he was necessarily a good fit here either. So the fact that we won't be seeing him twice a year doesn't necessarily bother me.
You know, Salk, that's the best thing that happened in this situation. My analysis on the situation, as long as he's not in the NFC West, as long as he's not in the NFC, that's fantastic news for Seahawks fans.
Yeah, I mean, and who knows? I mean, this may end up being a salary cap crippler for Tennessee and could have been for one of the NFC West teams. And he had obviously foot issues throughout his career and a hamstring issue last year. So, you know, I don't know what the future holds for Julio Jones. He's definitely still a good player. I don't know if he's necessarily a great one anymore. And so, you know, let him be somewhere else and let somebody else find all that out. We've got plenty to worry about here in the NFC West.
He is Mike Salk, joins us every weekday at 11:30. Thanks, Mike.
All right, guys. See ya.
All right, fans will see Julio at a Seahawks game, but it'll be on the other team's sideline in week two. Now that we know the terms, should the Hawks have made the deal for one of the league's best receivers? Text into the Mac and Jacks text line, 710-710. We'll talk about that next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Ross.
We are taking you around the diamond thanks to Shane Company, your friend in the jewelry business. The Mariners have the day off today, but will begin a three-game series tomorrow on the road against Detroit. Marco Gonzalez will be making the start. First pitch is at 4:10 p.m. Pre-game show starts at 3 p.m. right here on 710 ESPN Seattle. And that's Around the Diamond, brought to you by Shane Company, your friend in the jewelry business. Speaking of Mariners, Gary Hill Jr., producer and play-by-play for the Mariners Radio Network, will be joining us in 15 minutes. So much to ask him. Before we get to that, though, we have to talk about this Julio Jones trade. A blockbuster deal went down over the weekend. The Titans acquiring Julio Jones from the Falcons, taking on the all of his $15.3 million salary, that salary fully guaranteed, no matter what Julio was getting that money. They also send over a second-round pick And what, a sixth rounder to the Falcons, or a fourth rounder in 2023 to the Falcons. Falcons send over Julio in a sixth. There are a couple people, actually I'd say more than a couple people, Jake, really upset that the Seahawks didn't make this deal. Not only upset the Seahawks didn't make this deal, Jalen Ramsey of the Rams, a little bummed that the Rams didn't make this deal. I mean, I'm guessing that every other team outside of Tennessee and Atlanta is wishing Julio Jones was on their offense because he makes you that much better. I am not mad the Seahawks didn't do this.
Well, I think it's rich coming from Ramsey because it's like, dude, they just paid you a boatload of money, and the fact that they gave up a ton of capital to draft you or to trade for you, where what other capital do they have? But
you could say the same for Russell Wilson.
Well, they didn't trade for him.
They didn't trade for him.
Did they trade two first-round picks and multiple?
No, but they're paying $35
million. Sure, they are. But that to me doesn't make a difference in terms of what they're able to get and not get for him. In Ramsey's case, they had to trade and pay him. It'd be like Jamal Adams coming out here in Seattle saying, oh, why didn't we go after this guy? You guys should have went after him. After they're looking at you going, well, because we used all of our serious capital on you, bro. Like, what were we talking about? I think that when it comes down to Julio Jones and why you have reaction from people like this is because they just look at what they traded for, the draft capital itself. When you just look at it, just that alone, a second and what was it, a fifth, sixth in next year?
Second and fourth.
So you have second and fourth, and the fourth is a 2023 draft pick. So that is not a whole lot.
Yeah, but it's not the draft pick.
That's not the compensation. Exactly. It isn't. It's about the $15.3 million that the team has to take on, and that's why you didn't see a huge market for Julio Jones that everybody was anticipating. And the only thing that I'm bummed about is not that the Seahawks didn't go for it. It's the fact that the Tennessee was willing to take on that $15 million. If Tennessee wasn't willing to take that on, I really truly believe that the Seahawks would have been more interested, and there would have been a hotter market for Julio Jones around the league, but teams didn't want to take on that huge price tag, and rightfully so. And so when you look at that perspective in the Seahawks, I don't think that you want to look at this year trying to barely squeeze in Julio Jones, and then the following 2 years, it looks like they have a whole ton of capital that it wouldn't matter in their cap space if they brought on Julio Jones. But in 2022 and 2023, they have so much cap space because they have less than half of their guys currently under a contract heading into those years. So it's a little bit deceiving. That money, there's not a ton of money to go around ultimately when it comes to putting that roster construction together. So I get why the Seahawks didn't go for it from that perspective. But for everybody out there that's saying that it wouldn't work, it wouldn't come together, I don't think it would be a smart move. I think that that is way too overstated. I think that this monster, this three-headed monster that could have potentially happened between Tyler, DK, and Julio Jones in an alternate world, I think they could have absolutely made that work.
Yeah, the issue with Julio for me, from my point of view, wasn't a fit. I know that people are kind of, including me, teasing about him blocking for Derrick Henry in Tennessee, and some people see Seattle's offense as being like that. I don't think that's the case, and I don't think that'll be the case in 2021 either. The issue for me was salary, and I have to believe the Seahawks would have made this deal on the same terms, second and fourth and whatever, if they could have paid half of Julio's salary. In fact, Albert yeah. Breer of Sports Illustrated said that all four NFC West teams reached out to Atlanta in hopes of trying to get that down, presumably.
So
and he also says that Atlanta, I know, and he also says Atlanta never got a first round offer, which I think everyone kind of assumed. And everyone was like, of course you did. You have a boyfriend. He just doesn't go here. Like, that's exactly what Atlanta was doing.
Or maybe Brian, you know, talking about
I don't know
Brian,
what you're talking about.
It's like the greatest game of BS. Everybody knows that it is.
That's exactly
it
right.
is a lie, and you want to scream that out. But, you know, everybody's being nice and talking about it behind the scenes.
But also, that salary is no joke. $15.3 million. And I know you say that Russell Wilson, his salary alone shouldn't keep you from having to pay that. But it's not just, okay, you've got Russell Wilson, now go get Julio. There's so many other factors here at play. You've got to extend Jamal Adams. It would be great if with that extension you can make his cap hit this year $2 million or so.
Which I think they will.
I think they could. I don't know if they will. They absolutely could. We've seen teams do that with guys that they've acquired as recently as this March in free agency that have been able to do that. The Kansas City Chiefs are one of them, with, I think, Joe Tooney that had, I think, $2 or $5 million. Some ridiculously low number considering his overall salary. You've also got to pay DK Metcalf next year. You just paid Tyler Lockett again. You brought back Chris Carson. You paid Gabe Jackson $9.5-ish million. You paid a bunch of defensive ends to bring them in. You've got to account for Bobby's salary. There's a lot of money being spent for Seattle. Would it have been incredibly tempting to find money to bring in Julio Jones, knowing he would make your offense better? Because I do think he would have been a great fit. Yeah. Would you have had to make sacrifices elsewhere if you were not willing to restructure? Yes.
You would have to make sacrifices in 2022 and 2023. That's really where the sacrifices would come down to in terms of the overall strength of your roster, meaning being able to facilitate and put together a great roster top to bottom, offense and defense.
Well, you would have had to find room this year, though.
You would have, and I think that they could have. I think that there's creative ways that they could have made that happen. But again, this is talking about if that salary number was able to go down. They never would have been in this conversation with that $15 million number. And as we had talked about and speculated, that was truly the case. So with the Seahawks, to me, the argument of saying, well, we have bigger needs, we have more glaring needs at the cornerback position, I agree with you, but at the same time, are you closer to being an elite offense and putting together a team that Super Bowl-wise can be carried by your offense, or are you closer to being able to do that with your defense? I think the obvious answer is your offense is more primed and ready to be able to get that done than your defense is at this point in time. And if you really, truly believe, and that's the key, if they feel like they could have made that work, between Julio, DK, Tyler, Chris Carson, Gerald Everett, there's no rule saying you can't have a certain amount of elite weapons. There's no rule saying that that would be unfair or that it can't work. I think that that would have worked. It would have put defenses in an incredible bind across the board, and you would have had a truly explosive elite offense. The question is, can your defense be able to hold its end to at least win games? That's the ultimate question that you would have, but I do think that you would have a roster offensively that would be able to carry the workload unlike they were at last year, because simply they didn't have enough weaponry underneath DK and Tyler, at least an offense that wasn't able to facilitate the ball and distribute it to everybody else. I don't think you'd run into that same issue this year.
I agree with you, especially with the new offensive coordinator and with an improvement at left guard. However, I don't think you can afford to take away from this defense. And I would challenge anyone. And you know what? Correct me if I'm wrong. Please, like, you can fight with me on the text line. If you can find, tell me the last Super Bowl winner that had a defense that was like 25 or lower. It can be in, let's say, like total yards allowed, right? Like, it might take you a while to find that one. And maybe it'll be like, I don't know, the Giants random wild card team. Like, it's going to be a weird team. And you can, the 2016 Falcons went to a Super Bowl with an offense that was much better than defense, and they lost. I just think you got to be a little careful putting a little too much emphasis. And it's so rich for me to say this because I am team score as many points as possible. Like, I have been, I was hammering that home last year. And you know what? I'm going to do it again this year. And I'm going to say every time they don't surpass 24 points per game, you're in trouble. I'm going to continue to do that. But you, their defense is, right now in my mind, Jake, and we have to cut this short, but at a level where I don't think they can dip lower without really putting the team in jeopardy, if that makes sense.
No, it does. I definitely understand, and I get the argument on both sides. But to your point, you're contradicting yourself a little bit, because if they're not able to consistently perform on offense and consistently put that together,
right, because of defense spot where they have to be better.
Yes, you're forcing the issue for your defense to have to be better. They have to be not perfect, but they have to be a top 15 level defense, or else this thing just simply isn't going to work. And so that part of it to me is one of the unique balancing points for the Seahawks and where they're at, and why I think it's not crazy or wasn't crazy for them to be a part of the conversation with Julio Jones.
Certainly was not crazy. We'll jump back to this conversation at 1:30. Coming up next, we've got Gary Hill Jr. We've got plenty of Mariners questions, sending them his way. Text us 710-710 if you guys want more for Gary. That's coming up next.